enough for Republicans to wake up. The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Thanks for downloading the very latest in-depth interview podcast from peterbcollins.com. In a moment, I think it's a priceless interview, a conversation with Bill Ayers and his wife of more than 40 years, Bernadine Dorn. Ayers famously was described as the terrorist that Barack Obama was palling around with. That was Sarah Palin's characterization in 2008. And Ayers' new book called Public Enemy is a very interesting memoir of his experiences during that time and at other points in his life. We'll bring you Bill Ayers and Bernadine Dorn in just a moment. But first, I want to thank the people who subscribe and make this podcast work. Mary Vogt just signed up for an annual subscription, joining Mona Kobus, Michael Petty, and Linda Gray as subscribers. You can do it too. Go to my website at peterbcollins.com. Follow the links under my picture that say sign up. Our options include $5 a month, you can cancel anytime, or $50 a year. That's the best deal for our annual subscription. New annual subscribers qualify for a bag of kick-ass Kona coffee and our current bonus book, Spying on Democracy by Heidi Boghossian. The other way you can support us is to steer your web business to GoDaddy.com. Right now, if you sign up for web hosting with unlimited storage and bandwidth, the rates start at just $1.99 a month, and they'll give you your domain name free. For an absolutely screaming deal at GoDaddy, follow the link in the show file for this podcast at peterbcollins.com.
Brothers and sisters! Brothers and sisters! I don't know what this world is coming to!
Yes! The rhythm, the rebel, without applause.
Public Enemy is the musical artist. The song is Rebel Without a Pause. And I think it's the perfect setup. As Bill Ayers visits our secret studio here in California to talk about his new memoir called Public Enemy, Confessions of an American Dissident. And Bill, I would suggest that you are a rebel who has never really paused.
I think without a pause is about right. And I love hearing Chuck D sing that. And it immediately brings to mind Fight the Power, which is the most famous Public Enemy tune. So it's great to hear Chuck D and Public Enemy, and great to be here with you, Peter.
Well, thanks for joining us. And your wonderful wife, Bernadine Dorn, is here with us, too. And she was going to sit on the other side, but I asked her to step up to a microphone. I'm glad you're here.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, and I just want to express my gratitude to both of you for your activism on so many fronts over the years. You really do seem to be tireless, and you seem to, you're both teachers, and it seems that by passing your passions to the next generations that you develop new energy and new abilities to confront the ugly machines of power.
I hope so. I think so. I mean, one of the wonderful things about being a teacher is you never lose touch with young people. And we have lived, well, for the last 40 years, over 40 years together in very much a multi-generational community. And the movement groups that we belong to are, you know, ageless and multi-generational. And that's been a great gift and something that keeps us going without a doubt.
There's also a legacy. I was number four in the last Nixon draft lottery. And had your efforts not ultimately led to the end of the Vietnam War, I probably would have been drafted into the military. I did achieve conscientious objector status from the Selective Service, but there was no guarantee that would hold, because a lot of people were losing those deferments on appeal.
Well, I'm delighted that you didn't have to go in. One of my brothers was drafted and went in, then ended up deserting and joining the Great Migration, which was a social movement to Canada and away from militarism and the demand that you either shoot or be shot. So I'm glad you didn't have to do that. Let me quarrel with one little thing.
Sure.
I don't know that our efforts ended the war. We certainly wanted our efforts to end the war. We were activists for the entire length of that war. I was first arrested in 1965 in a draft board in Ann Arbor, Michigan, with 39 other students trying to raise a screaming alarm about the war. Mm-hmm. And certainly in the 3 years from 65 to 68, a majority of the Americans got the word, and the war became unpopular, and that's a terrific thing. But we have to remember that the war ground on for 7 more years. Yeah. Every week that it went on, 6,000 people were murdered. And when it came to ending it, it really was the Vietnamese themselves that drove the Americans from the roof of their own embassy in Saigon, and who can forget those iconic images. But it's always been a great disappointment to me that we weren't able to do more. We weren't able to be more effective. And I don't mean we, the weathermen in particular, or we, me and Bernadine in particular. I mean the great anti-war movement that mobilized. I think we limited their options, but I don't think we stopped the war.
But it is worth noting, I think, that it was the greatest anti-war mobilization. It was more than a sentiment. It was a mobilization.
You opened minds. You educated a lot of people who were tuned out. You made a major difference. I will accept your correction,
yeah.
Okay? But you started people's thinking in directions that challenged the status quo.
I want to say...
And that lingers on.
I think that's right. And I think my work around the war started... actually, on the west side of Chicago with Dr. King. So, ironically, my path to anti-war land came through the Black Freedom Movement in Chicago and working there and finding myself, by the summer of 66, being asked more and more as a law student to do draft resistance counseling and military counseling to young people on the west side of Chicago. So it shows you, in a way, what the moment was and how those issues got merged. And then one last thing to throw into your little dialogue here back and forth. Can't underestimate the role of the returning vets from Vietnam and today.
Yeah,
I think that the people who came back and told the truth and tried to understand, make meaning of the terrible experience that they just had, even the glorious parts of the experience they just had, but really the crimes that they were asked to commit as policy on a daily basis, they really changed, they deepened the anti-war understanding in the United States in the most profound way. And the vets today continue to do that. They're really an inspiration to us.
And now, your book is not really about Obama, the president. It's about your experiences being tied to Obama in a cartoonish way. And we'll get to that. But I want to ask you, while we're talking about the anti-war movements and the ebb and flow, that we saw a lot of activity during the Bush administration, people who were opposed to, first and foremost, the invasion of Iraq, but they started to doubt that Afghanistan was the right response to 9/11 in due course. But since Obama has become president, my friend Medea Benjamin at Code Pink laments that she had 125 chapters across the country in 2008, and there are less than a dozen today. And that even when we saw the threat by Obama to attack Syria in August and September of this year, it was a much broader-based resistance and a more political one. But the anti-war people who were out against Bush are still largely silent, as Obama has expanded our war footprint, has expanded the autocratic use of presidential power to put people on a list and kill them with a drone, including American citizens, without process. I don't need to tell you any of this. So What do you say, Bill?
Well, I mean, I think that the anti-war sentiment in this country is wide. It's not deep, but it's wide. And I look to people like Medea Benjamin to really, as kind of not only leaders, but inspirations for all of us about what we should be doing. I think there's no question that the anti-war sentiment is there. What we saw in Syria was a tremendous reaction against war. But that sentiment is not mobilized and it's not active enough. And that's our job, really. That's our task. I look at the Obama administration and nothing about it surprises me because candidate Obama said in 2008 and again 2012, and he's proved it in Illinois and ever since, that I am a moderate, middle-of-the-road, pragmatic politician. He also agreed to be commander-in-chief, sitting in the throne of empire, commanding its violent legions. So you can't, you know, you have to note that that's the role he plays. I think progressives too often get derailed into wringing their hands and wondering if the president, in this case, can do something to help us, can bring about peace or so on. But peace will not be brought about by the commander-in-chief or by the generals or by the Pentagon. It will only be brought about when we can mobilize a strong and lasting and thorough anti-war force in this country.
Well, I just want to note that Medea Benjamin's book on drones is a must-read. Mm-hmm. It's a primer. It's almost a teach-in in itself, a short little book on how where they're made, how they're made, how they got deployed like this, and how we can stop them. And I think her work and the work of really the peace activists who are still there, religious forces, Kathy Kelly, the whole network of people who refuse to go
home. Colonel Ann Wright,
exactly.
Is an amazing, inspiring person.
Is something that should inspire all of us. And mm-hmm. my hope is that we take the moment you described so well, Peter, of kind of the broad, including, you know, Republican and apolitical American public saying no to bombing Syria mm-hmm. as a spark that we can't miss. We must actually deepen that and connect it to the other issues. We have to connect it to global warming, and to war and warming are very connected. We have to connect it to immigrant rights. We have to connect it to food and the future of our children and mm-hmm. to education. So I think it's a huge opportunity for peace. I'll tell you a story. We had NATO come to Chicago a year and a half ago, may remember. It was going to be NATO and the G8. And then when they took a look at what we were building as a massive
welcoming committee.
Welcoming committee. Thank you. Flooding of the city with activists. They decided two things. One was to peel off the G8 and have it in secret. And the other is to use Chicago as a lockdown, as a practice, really, mm-hmm. of military lockdown and future kind of exercise.
Yeah, who needs posse comitatus?
It was an unbelievable experience, and still.
But you felt safer, didn't you, when those tanks rolled in the streets?
I mean,
terrified.
No, they moved people out of every apartment building on Lakeshore Drive months in advance. Take this week off. Take your holiday here. They shut down downtown Chicago, of course, with the collaboration of our terrible mayor, Mayor Rahm Emanuel, who was doing their bidding. And they really made it an absolute military state. They deputized everybody. There were, you know, garbage trucks and snow machines with sharp edges lined up along Lakeshore. And nonetheless, you know, thousands of people came out on a 110-degree day, led by the vets, Vietnam vets and Iraqi and Afghan vets, who really sparked, I think, the entire spirit of the thing. Mm-hmm. And threw their medals back at the NATO generals, you know, with very compelling stories. And so I think we don't have to do those kind of big demonstrations all the time. Who knows what form it'll mm-hmm. take now.
Well, we were talking about Medea a moment ago, and I really want to ask your reaction, Bernadine, because I was so struck by her, it was described as heckling, But she was in the audience when Obama gave this speech in May at the National War University, and he was wringing his hands. I thought it was a very interesting speech that he gave, where he was saying, stop me from killing more people with drones, and please, will somebody help me close Guantanamo? And she stood up, and she had planted herself so deeply in the hall that it took a minute and a half for them to escort her out. And the whole time, without missing a beat, without an or a pause, she just pilloried Obama in a very correct way, to the point where he had to respond and acknowledge the accuracy of what she was lecturing
him
on.
He actually said, listen to what this woman
yeah,
is
as if
saying.
He didn't know who she is.
Exactly. I mean, how does she always get in? And how does she always keep her head while being dragged out?
Yeah.
But you're right. It was a perfect moment. And I think you're also right to get the double whammy of his administration and of power. On the one hand, he's, you know, waging warfare on the world, as empire seemed, and, you know, the capitalist imperative seems must do. So more countries, you know, being bombed, war. This is war in Pakistan, you know, and the consequences of it, the blowback, will be with us now for another decades.
Mm-hmm.
But he also is the guy who said during the campaign, when asked during the primary, I think, who would Dr. King support, you or Hillary, without the usual thoughtful pause before he speaks, he said he wouldn't support either of us. He'd be out in the streets building the movement for justice. So he does know that.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think that it is we should just stop worrying about what he's going to do and do kind of both the direct action stuff that Medea does so brilliantly, or Kathy Kelly does in her domain, and get to work, you know, actively organizing and actively demanding for the future of the planet and the future of our children that we close foreign military bases, that we stop the war machine, that we denuclearize immediately. This opening in Syria is very interesting, right? Chemical weapons in Syria. Okay, now what about chemical weapons in the region?
Yeah,
Israel. Who's the other big holder?
Yeah.
Israel. And then how about chemical weapons, those who make them and store them,
well,
the United States?
Well, the United States has not destroyed its chemical weapons stockpile. We're saying it takes too long. You know, this machine we use, it's slow.
So these are openings for us.
And the same is true of nuclear weapons. No nuclear weapons in Iran. Okay, no nuclear weapons in the region. Now we're talking about Israel. No nuclear weapons in the world. But I want to return to Bernadine's point and to your point, really, about Medea. We need people like Medea Benjamin to show us what courage looks like and to show us that you can speak truth to power in a very public and vocal way. It amazes us always that she gets into these places, but we've seen her close up over many years. We were in Cairo with her trying to get to on the Freedom Gaza march, and you know, the Egyptian police moved on one of our comrades and a Palestinian brother. And before we even knew what was happening, Medea had hurled her tiny body on top of this guy, face up, and said, don't touch him, don't touch him. And after the Obama moment that you describe, she said the next day to Amy Goodman, you know, Amy said, how could you get three chances to say that? And she said, well, they came up to me to take me out. And I said, if you touch me, I'm going to start screaming. Mm-hmm. So they didn't touch her. Then she piped up again.
And slow walked.
Exactly. So she shows us how to be an activist. But one thing I would say, you know, in terms of the task before us, is that there is an anti-war sentiment. People want to believe that we are a peace-loving people. We know that it's a war state, a carceral state, a war nation. But people want to be peace-loving, and therefore we have the opportunity to organize. People need Medea Benjamin, for sure, but they also need to feel in their own hearts that if they act, we can change things. And that's one of the missing elements. It's not only framing the issue properly, which we have to do and we have to do a better job of, we have to point out again and again that our military bases around the world do not make America safer. They make the world unstable and they make us less safe.
Mm-hmm.
If we could convince people that we need to be a nation among nations, not the Uber nation, but a country among countries, that's one step. But the other step is believing that if I take an action, I can actually affect the outcome of that. That's something that we have to find ways to organize around, and we have to prove it through practice. We have to prove it by doing it.
Now, Bill, to that particular point, I made the comment after Obama's bluff on Syria was called that the emergence of Vladimir Putin as the adult...
Who could imagine?
Was a shocking development, and even Chloe is surprised at that.
Yes.
And I do believe that it was a potential, not a tipping point, but a shifting point, where we had to recognize that the, you know, superpower status of the United States had just been tarnished in the same way that the invincibility of Israel was destroyed by Hezbollah just a few years back. And I think that if the United States does accept a kind of leveling of our stature, that we would be much better off, and we would be fueling fewer jihadis who have legitimate gripes about the United States. And here I'm sounding like Reverend Wright.
Well, I think you're absolutely correct, and there's no doubt about it. But I think what's interesting about the Putin moment, and of all the strange messengers, Putin, but he united MSNBC and Fox against him because they all agreed, the liberals and the conservatives, that America is the indispensable nation. America is the exceptional nation. And as long as we buy into that fraud, then we are in for a really rough ride as empire declines, because we are not an exceptional nation. There's no such thing, and no one in the world could possibly buy it. But the idea that we don't have to be held to the same standards when it comes to torture or extrajudicial assassinations.
Chemical weapons. Like white phosphorus.
Nukes, or using nukes. Mm-hmm. Or destroying Fallujah. Or we could give 1,000 examples. But we don't hold ourselves to that same standard. And increasingly, the world is turning away from that. And while we have military superiority, the United States is the biggest military behemoth that's ever been assembled, but it has less and less and less economic authority and dramatically less political authority.
Mm-hmm.
We have to fold in here the Edward Snowden moment, the Chelsea Manning moment, mm-hmm. WikiLeaks and Anonymous. This is a very powerful and positive development. Americans don't like it. They don't want to. We know that 1984 is no longer a theoretical possibility. It's a fact. But what we see with Edward Snowden is us watching them watching us. Mm-hmm. And it's revealing as hell. And it's very important. So I see all these things connected. I think we're at a powerful moment for mobilization and deepening of a radical consciousness.
So I will get to your book, Bill, but this is too fascinating. I've been doing a lot of coverage of the NSA scandal well before Ed Snowden surfaced. And I collaborate with a woman named Sibel Edmonds, who is a whistleblower fired from the FBI for exposing the presence of a Turkish double agent in her unit. And she was gagged by John Ashcroft and subjected to all kinds of intimidating legal maneuvers over a period of time. And through her, I've interviewed many whistleblowers. And let me be specific about one. Russell Tice was a high-level NSA official, and he has disclosed that he personally participated in the installation of wiretaps on Senator Feinstein, who now chairs the Intelligence Committee, and on a guy named Obama, who he'd never heard of. The wiretap was installed in 2004. When he gave his speech at the Democratic National Convention and first surfaced as a national figure. And so when we put that against the backdrop of Keith Alexander, who runs the NSA, being the guy who's the new J. Edgar Hoover, who can collect dirt in a way that is exponential over what Hoover was able to do. And it begs the question, you know, how did they get to Obama and why did he change? Because I do take the point you made earlier, that he was a moderate in Illinois. He flipped on single payer very early in the game, and we know that. That, to me, was a real marker about Obama.
Or the death penalty, where we had a movement against the death penalty, and mm-hmm. State Senator Obama was still trying to compromise with that.
But as a law professor, I had the lowered expectation that he was going to return us to constitutional rule. And so given this backdrop and Tice's allegations of wiretapping Obama, is there, in your view, the prospect or possibility, a scenario, that he has been compromised in some way? and that the deep state is calling the shots and telling him he's got to go to the UN and give a speech about exceptionalism after he just, you know, got his comeuppance from Putin.
You know, one of the things that I have thought since I became one of the leaders of SDS and started traveling around the Vietnam War is that when you see the workings of power, which we usually only see after the fact, but now we've had enough after the fact, 50 years since the Kennedy assassination, for example, we don't have to go to the actual conspiracy thing, because the way it works is with extreme power, extreme money, and, you know, extreme seduction, and if necessary, extreme violence. So I think my own read of the situation is that you don't go for the presidency and you don't take the presidency in the United States of America. And you could say this about many other countries, too, if you're not willing to do the bidding of power. It's in the definition. It's in the chair that you sit in.
Mm-hmm.
So I am able to stop just with that idea. I think that, and I also think that we, you know, Obama, like many candidates before him, was so successful during the 2008 campaign because everybody could pin their hopes on him as a newcomer. Of course, we had watched him for 6 or 7 years before that. So I wouldn't say we weren't excited. You know, electing the first African-American president was its own thrilling moment, and changing generations was its own thrilling moment, and so on. But I think, like Kennedy before him, he does represent America at a certain moment, and he is the, when he's sitting in the White House chair and maybe before and after, is the leader of empire. And the effort, the clear fact that we continually hear in speech after speech that America is the exceptional nation, that we have God-given rights to lead the world, when if you step for a second outside, look at Latin America, look at Africa, look at Asia, look at Europe, the rest of the world.
I look at Oakland.
You see,
at Oakland, exactly.
You can look internally as well, with the changing demographics and so on, or the prison nation, you know, the gulag that we've created. But I'm looking out for a minute. You know, 5% of the world's people, a declining economic power, a much weakened political force, and nothing could be clearer in the Syria moment than that. And militarily still the only card to play often. That's a terrible formula. And it's what makes, I think, people crazy at this moment about why we can be so hopeful. Because it looks like, you know, a savage and vicious right wing arising and the center falling out. That is the kind of moment that we're in.
Yeah. Bill?
I would just add, I mean, we're looking at the Obama administration, we're looking at the presidency of Barack Obama. But I think for us, we often think that progressives, liberals in particular, but progressives, radicals even, spend too much time staring at the sites of power we have no access to. The president is one example. The Congress, which is some overheated, you know, auction house where everything's for sale. We look at these things and we worry a lot about these things and we wring our hands, but those aren't the places we have access. What we do have access to is the street, the community, the workplace, the school, the classroom, the library. And it's to these places that we should really be spending more of our attention. That's why when we came in this morning, we were talking about what just happened at SeaTac Airport, what just happened in, you know, getting rid of fracking here or getting marriage equality in Illinois. These are the kinds of things where we think there's real energy from below. And frankly, if you look even glancingly at the history of the last 150 years, Lyndon Johnson never belonged to the Black Freedom Movement. FDR never belonged to the labor movement. Lincoln never belonged to an abolitionist party. Those three presidents are remembered for great things because there were great social movements from below bringing the fire, bringing the power. That's where we ought to be spending our time.
All right, let's turn to your book now. There are many fascinating aspects of it, but I want to start by telling you that a few weeks ago I was in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and I sat down and got to the portion of your book of September 12th of 2001.
It was actually September 11th.
So it was the morning of the 11th.
September 11th, yes.
Okay, right. And the New York Times that day published a review of your book, Fugitive Days, and I forget who wrote the review.
Denisha Smith, and it was on the front page of the arts section of the Times on the morning of September 11th, 2001.
Right. And she characterized you as kind of insufficiently repentant. Would that be fair?
Well, the headline of the article she wrote was called
No Regrets
for a Lifetime Love of Explosives, which was not number one, not true, and number two, an unfortunate headline for the morning of September 11th.
Yeah. And you were in Ann Arbor yourself.
I was.
On September 11th.
I was. I was on book tour. Bernadine was in Chicago. And we were talking on the phone about that article.
It was the start. It was the really the pub date of his book, of his memoir, Fugitive Days. And he was speaking in Ann Arbor that night. And we talked early in the morning as soon as the attack started, the attack on the World Trade Center, because we had our children in motion around the world. We were trying to track our children, and I was getting phone calls from one son in Chile, if you can imagine, the anniversary of the coup against Allende. He called me to say, "Mom, I just got tear gassed," very excitedly. And I said, "Do you know what's happening here?" And he said, "Oh, yeah, I heard about it. Talk about the view outside the United States," right? He was in another world. He had another son who was at the airport going back to college, called me and said, "Something's crazy's happening. They've just shut down the airport." And I went to get him. But I was talking to Bill on the phone, and I said, "Come back. Come back. The book tour's off." And he said, "No, no, no. I'm going to stay here and do the book talk. You can pick it up from there."
Well, of course not. It wasn't just the book tour that was canceled. And I think that morning changed so much for so many people, and then a lot didn't change. That's worth remembering, too. But the fact that Fugitive Days had a bumpy debut into the world is a rather small price, given the horrors that went on that day and that continued for months and years afterwards.
Just a quick question. Do you believe the official story of 9/11 and the work of the 9/11 Commission?
You know, I have no way of knowing beyond what I can speculate. But we were in Venezuela a year, 2 years after 9/11. And there were a couple of interesting things about that trip. We were on a speaking trip throughout Venezuela and showing a movie. And not once, every audience we addressed, there were two questions that we could count on. One was, "Don't you think that George Bush did this to the United States?" That was one question. And the second question was, "Are they going to invade Venezuela?" And these were so predictable that we got into a kind of a rhythm of answering. My response is, are they capable? Of course they're capable. They're capable of all kinds of, atrocities and horrific behavior. So they're capable, but I have no way of knowing. On the question of the invasion of Venezuela, are they capable? You bet. Would they like to? Of course. But the interesting thing is they are also pinned down. The greatest military power on earth is pinned down all around the world, probably doesn't have the resources to mess with Chavez at that moment.
Well, we did work to overthrow him.
No
without
question.
A doubt. Pretty clear.
No question.
Without a doubt.
Yeah.
And we do
and
that.
And continual subversion of Cuba,
sure.
Of course. Those things go on. But in fact, the United States was diverted for the last decade and a half from Latin America and from the Americas. And I think the countries in this continent took advantage of that in a great way and have really strengthened their independence economically and politically.
One of the real touching aspects of the book, one of the narratives that you offer, is when you, Bernadine, went to jail for almost a year. For refusing to appear before a grand jury where they wanted you to testify against Kathy Bodine and others. And I'll just point out that you adopted Kathy's son, Chesa. Is that?
Mm-hmm. Chesa.
Chesa, uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And I'd like you to talk about that because I have a friend who is currently behind bars in Shelby County, Alabama. He's a journalist named Roger Shuler. And he's been publishing articles that are critical of powerful Republicans in the state and that have exposed extramarital affairs of family values Republicans. And they got an injunction, which is unconstitutional, ordering him to take down these posts without any finding of defamation. And also, prospectively, they banned him from publishing anything about these people in the future.
Wow.
And it's now 2 weeks. We're speaking on Wednesday the 6th. He has been in jail for 14 days. There's a virtual media blackout. We've been trying to get coverage. And he is standing on his principle, one lawyer who said, well, all you got to do is take this stuff down and you'll get out. And Roger said no. So that's a very long-winded warm-up to your experience. But could you please talk about what gave you strength to maintain your position? And ultimately, the judge had to accept that you were not going to testify.
You know, it is a lovely part of Bill's book. And, of course, it was a miserable part of our lives together and our lives as parents in particular. Grand jury was invented in England as a democratizing buffer between the king's total power and the people so that the king solo couldn't indict people and throw them into the jail. And so, but of course, it's become its total opposite now. And in fact, England has banned the grand jury, and much of the world has banned the grand jury, and many states have banned the grand jury. But the United States federal government has found it a useful tool to coerce people into talking, to lock them up until they are willing to talk or provide evidence. About what? Well, you don't know, actually. They're conducting some investigation about something somewhere. I think your idea, you just made me think there should be a grand jury watch. There should be some group that actually is tracking how many grand juries there are around the country at a given moment and really, really push this wretched and undemocratic institution out of existence. It really is ready to go. And many lawyers and bar associations think it's a wretched institution. We had three little kids.
Mm-hmm.
Brinks had happened 6 months before. We had just turned ourselves in after 11 years on the run. We lived in a fifth-floor walk-up in Manhattan. We were trying to rebuild a life with three tiny little kids, and we bounded downstairs with backpacks and lunch bags early one morning in May to find two guys stepping out from between a car and saying, "Miss Dorn," and handing me a subpoena for a federal grand jury investigating the Brinks robbery.
Mm-hmm.
I knew right away that I would not, under any circumstances, cooperate with this grand jury. Many people themselves had put themselves on the line and risked going to jail for us in the years that we were underground. But more than that, it's really a coercive institution that has to be resisted. But we had these three little children. That was a different force. I did go to jail. Bill and our oldest son, Zaid, walked into the courtroom with me. Kissing the other boys goodbye was bitter, sweet, bitter, bitter. Interestingly, it was 17 people indicted at that time, 16 of whom were mothers of young children.
Not indicted, called to the grand jury.
Subpoenaed and jailed. So there we were in federal prison. And our kids, the daycare center and our community on the Upper West Side mobilized and brought the children once a week individually to visit with me. Bill came every single day as well as taking care of the kids and working and running around with lawyers. The terrible part about a grand jury is you don't know when you're going to get out.
Mm-hmm.
It's endless.
Yeah.
Theoretically. That part makes it hard. If you said 4 months, 5 months, you can measure it and deal with it.
And that's why unlimited detention, whether it's at Guantanamo
or
prospectively
Pelican Bay,
under the NDAA, so onerous.
Or Pelican Bay,
yeah.
Solitary indeterminate solitary confinement. So that part of it is quite haunting and terrible.
And can I underscore that this was very much on the principle, because as I understand it, you didn't have any information that they could have squeezed out of you.
Exactly. I had nothing to do with the Brinks action, and I didn't agree with it.
Mm-hmm.
Many people I respect and admire were apparently involved with it, but that is separate from the action itself, which I was not part of.
Yeah.
So no, I had nothing to contribute. And I think after 8 or 9 months, they realized that. But I think their initial suspicions were that somehow I was a ringleader,
mm-hmm.
whatever. Who knows what their initial suspicions were. They actually asked me not to give oral testimony, but to give handwriting samples. And the FBI had rooms full somewhere mm-hmm. of my handwriting samples. That was not a mystery. So it seemed to me to be very pretext
mm-hmm.
based and not actually information based. So our kids came to visit. I practiced parenting from a distance. I, you know, tried to hold my breath. I had lots of legal visitors, and Bill somehow coming every day, working to get me out.
Well, you blossomed as a parent there. I mean, that's what I pick up from your description.
Perhaps. I don't know. I mean,
Single
parenting is tough. And my empathy for single parents went through the roof because, I mean, you know, the real thing about being a single parent is you're never off the clock. Even when you're not with the kids, you're always psychically on. So that was another story. But, Bernadine, you know, one of the things about you being in lockup was that you did get a lot of visitors, and we live in a carceral state. We live in a state where, you know, 2.5 million of our fellow citizens are in prison. And I think that you've made a point recently about how important it is for people on the outside to open their eyes to that reality.
Well, I think, you know, I've been saying that every single person should visit a prisoner. We live in a gulag state, and around us everywhere within 10 miles of here is a major prison.
San Quentin is 3 miles.
But that's true wherever we're speaking. Mm-hmm. That's true wherever we're speaking. And yet, for many of us, it's invisible as a daily mode. In Chicago, Cook County Jail,
mm-hmm.
pre-conviction people, now just past 10,000 young African-American and Latino men in the center of the city of Chicago. Why? Yeah.
Living in cages.
For want of bail.
Sure.
So this is, you know, we've become accustomed to this as if it's inevitable. And I'm feeling quite fiercely that one of the things that makes me very proud is that Illinois closed 3 prisons mm-hmm. last year, including the Supermax prison, the equivalent of Pelican Bay here. And the year before abolished the death penalty. So I'd just like to encourage Californians in the state competition here that Illinois
catch
is
up.
Way ahead.
You're right.
And I think 3 prisons a year is nothing to, it's a small thing to do. Let's close 3 prisons a year and let's stop the Supermax. And let's also visit people in prison. A lot of people came to visit me when I was in prison, when I was in federal lockup, it wasn't really prison,
mm-hmm.
In downtown Manhattan, who had never before been in a prison. I'll tell you the funniest story is my mother coming to visit, just a story in the book, in Bill's book. But my mom, who voted 4 times for Senator Joe McCarthy in Wisconsin growing mm-hmm. up, and who never imagined herself in the situation of being visited constantly by the FBI in the years I was underground, somehow always thought her daughter was a good girl, even if we didn't understand all the reasons why. And she came up to New York to visit me in prison, and she made herself go through the humiliating business that happens when you visit a prisoner, right? You're degraded, you're mm-hmm. searched, you're told you're not wearing the right things, you can't carry this, you can't have that. And
the no hostage policy is always heartwarming.
Exactly. And you have to wait, you know, and wait and wait, and you watch your time, precious time, being eroded. And so by the time she got up to visit me in the visiting room, women's visiting room, she was a wreck.
Mm-hmm.
In addition to her anxiety about me. And she wanted to know what each of the women in the room had done, you know, as if they'd done something. They were all there for nonviolent, you know, federal drug
mm-hmm.
charges. And anyway, we finally calmed down and had a lovely mother-daughter visit, in which case my mother, quite fearful of the situation, but with a spark of defiance, said to me, I have something for you. And I said, what do you have for me? And she said, I made a homemade chocolate chip cookie. It's in my bra. So maybe this is all genetic. Maybe there's a little defiance.
You know, I mean, in many ways, Bernadine going to jail or going to lockup to compel her testimony. She had a unique legal theory, which the court didn't agree with, which is if she has free speech, she has the freedom not to speak. They don't agree with that. It's not in the law. But that was her stance, and she stood by it. And one of the things about that story, and there are hundreds of stories in the book, is it really, it's the book is not so much about the moment of the Obama campaign. It's about four decades of trying to figure out how to live a life consistent with your values. And Bernadine, I've been lucky. I've been with her for four and a half decades almost. And it continues to inspire me. And that was one of the most difficult periods that we lived through, but we did live through it. And here she was kind of standing for the very issues that had fired her passion and her commitments when she was a young woman. Now she was a much older woman and still trying to figure out in changing circumstances, changing times, how do I continue to live that life? So there's a fine point in the law, which is you can put somebody in lockup to compel their testimony, but you cannot keep them there to punish them for not testifying. So our lawyers came up with a brilliant strategy. She'd had over 100 legal visits in the course of her months in lockup. And our lawyers, the Kennedys, decided that we would get affidavits from every lawyer saying, I visited with her, whatever they wanted to say about the visit, she will never talk. And we got over 100 affidavits, and we put them on the judge's desk. And after some consideration, he let her out. After
this is the judge, by the way, that the children called the Sheriff of Nottingham.
Yes.
Our three sons
our kids
considered him absolutely
He was somewhere
archdevil.
Between Darth Vader and the Sheriff of Nottingham. But I raced uptown when we got the release order. I raced uptown and got our kids and came back down, and we went with our lawyers to an Italian, their favorite Italian restaurant in Little Italy, and we were having a wonderful celebration. We were so, so relieved that we'd finally reached this point. And as dessert was ordered, I went down this narrow, dark hallway to the men's room, and I ran into the owner, Frankie, who was about my height, but muscled and broad and with no neck to speak of. And he said to me, our faces were uncomfortably close together, and he said to me, what's the celebration? And I swallowed hard. I didn't want to mention the Black Panther Party, the Weather Underground, or the Black Liberation Army, but I did feel like I ought to tell him. So I said, my wife just got out of prison, federal lockup. And he said, no shit. That lovely lady over there? And I said, that's her. She was covered with kids at this point. And he said, no shit. What was she in for? And then he said, kind of apologetically, I mean, if you don't mind my asking, because that's something you don't ask. And I decided to go forward, but again, in short form. And I said, she refused to cooperate with a grand jury. She refused to talk. And his voice rose. No shit, he said. She's a real stand-up chick. And I said, yes, she is. And then he picked up the bill. So that was the ending of a lovely vignette.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, during 2008, when the Clinton campaign was being eclipsed by the upstart Obama, they launched, just as it was Al Gore who first introduced Willie Horton.
Exactly.
That's so important to remember. Good
Nobody
for you.
Nobody remembers this.
This was
Save
a Democrat,
us from the liberals.
A Democrat on Democrat attack. So they first found Reverend Wright, which Sean Hannity had been playing the footage of some of Wright's sermons, and they were all edited for the most incendiary passages. I happen to think Reverend Wright is a guy who has a lot to say, and I like to listen to him.
He's amazing intellect. He's an amazing force in Chicago and the country. We love him.
So they first used Reverend Wright as this talking point to undermine Obama. And then they discovered Bill Ayers. So talk a little bit about the cartoon caricature that they created of you and that you had to watch basically hunkered down in your home and avoiding the media. You had to put yourself on sharp restrictions, and Bernadine, I think, had to reinforce it at certain times when you were ready to buckle. So talk a little bit about how all that played out.
You know, I'm not sure buckle is the right word. I mean, I am genetically programmed to speak up even when I don't know what I'm talking about. So it was a good thing that Bernadine and our three sons and my brother and a host of friends all figured out long before the attack started that I would be well served to just be quiet, to not enter into this presidential campaign by trying to explain myself. And as our oldest son said, if you do that, you'll be like a character in Kafka trying to set the record straight for 1,000 years, and it's just not worth it. So, yes, I was quiet, but I wasn't completely quiet. I was still teaching my classes. I was still speaking at universities. But I wouldn't say
that he was hunkered down, but I do think asking Bill to not speak publicly for 6 months is a very challenging
task. It's like asking your puppy not to bark.
I did recruit a committee because I felt that it would tear asunder our lovely laughing relationship if I were the enforcer. So there was a committee, and when Bill got...
The committee to keep Bill quiet.
That's
the committee
right.
To
and
say
it took
when,
a village.
When
it took a village.
Who enticed you? I mean, he had so many invitations to speak, and he'd say... Just this one. I mean, I'll just go on, you know, with Bill Moyers.
On,
I love Bill Moyers. He'll
I didn't
be great.
Want to go on, but I did get a message from Bill O'Reilly, an email saying, I know you're not going to talk to me, but couldn't you just give me your definition of terrorism? And I wrote to our son, our oldest son, and I said, I can do this. This is great. This will be easy. And he wrote back and said, Pops, you're watching the roller coaster. Please don't get on the roller coaster. And I think that was all good advice.
So he would call Malik or he would call Chaza, different ones of our sons, to beg them, just this one, you know.
Uh-huh.
But actually, he got into the discipline of the silence, and clearly it was the only thing to do in that moment.
And describe the media scrum.
Well, here was
and
what
the
happened.
The way they
you know, you're absolutely right, and it's terribly important, so I'm going to just underline it. It was Hillary Clinton who came up with the narrative, and the narrative was, here's this brilliant, charismatic, smart, forward-charging politician out of Illinois, Barack Obama. We don't know much about him. He's a mystery man.
He's African-American.
He's African-American. He's a little bit exotic. But what do we know about him? Not much. But we do know his friends. Jeremiah Wright, Rashid Khalidi was thrust into it, the Palestinian scholar.
I know Professor Khalidi.
A wonderful guy and a dear, dear friend of ours. And then me, the unrepentant domestic terrorist. Hillary used this narrative as far as she could. It failed for her. And McCain Palin picked it up and drove it forward. The tragedy of it, from our point of view, mostly fell around... Reverend Wright. Reverend Wright was at the point of retirement. He had made massive contributions to the welfare of the city of Chicago and the people of Chicago.
And to global justice. His parish into supporting South Africa long before any other black.
And can we contrast him to Jesse Jackson?
Well, I would say Jesse does good work as well.
Colleagues.
But I think that Reverend Wright, you know, you say he was highly edited. The fact is, if you take King's speeches from 65 to 68, Reverend Wright, his speeches aren't nearly as incendiary. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have kind of moderated King in our memory, and the prayer breakfasts are not for the radical King.
Mm-hmm.
But the radical King was the King we knew. And so, yeah, to us, that was terrible. But worse than that was the guilt by association.
Wait, so, I want to stay with Jeremiah Wright for a minute, because the reason his was the hardest is that Rashid was used to attacks, right? If you're a Palestinian-American, you grow up with it, you know it, you've lived with it.
And a public person like Rashid.
The city of New York, you know, went crazy putting pressure on Columbia University's, the Edward Said chair there. Mm-hmm. We're used to it. I mean, nothing was like the 2008 attacks, but it wasn't unfamiliar to us. I think Reverend Wright, in his distinguished career... and with his very large and vocal parish in Chicago, I mean, he took on controversy, but he just wasn't used to kind of being attacked himself. And so it's unique. It's a unique thing to be at the epicenter of becoming a public enemy. That's really what we meant.
Yeah. But the kids and Bernadine and my brother and others said, look, be quiet. And the way Zaid put it to me at one point was, if you are silent to the media during this whole thing, you will become calmer and more focused, and they will become more frenzied. That turned out to be exactly correct. Mm-hmm. I got up every morning. I was working on a graphic novel with a young collaborator. We got up every morning and worked on our graphic novel for 6 or 8 hours. Bernadine went to work and to teaching up at the law school. We did our life. We didn't turn the television on. I didn't read the New York Times. God, it's a toxic habit I have, reading that
which
stuff.
You've returned to.
I've returned to it. Oh, I can't help myself. It's like I sometimes think of it as I get up in the morning, I have a cup of coffee, and I read the New York Times. It's like two slaps in the face to get going. But I can't stand it.
But the Chicago papers suck more.
Well, they suck the worst. So I don't even bother with them. But in any case.
The point is, he wasn't, you know, he was teaching, and he was a professor, and he was doing his life.
And
but
I was
not,
writing my book. But outside was an encampment on our front lawn that was quite frenzied, and it got more and more frenzied. So I would go out and, you know, five people would shove microphones in my face, or I'd go to the local coffee shop. It was surreal and it was strange, but I found that it was calming to not pay attention to it and to not read about myself in the papers. If the kids wanted me to know something, like that I was a character on Saturday Night Live, they would let me know and then I would know. But
so how did you learn the line, the well, you know, soundbite line that was crafted and delivered by Sarah Palin, that Obama had been palling around with terrorists?
Yes, that deathless phrase was, you know, when she first uttered it, I believe it was in Michigan, I'm not certain, but she uttered it again and again. The first time she uttered it, the crowd started chanting, kill him, kill him. And I wasn't sure which they wanted to kill, Obama or me or both. It was surreal. And that little soundbite the kids had sent us, and we looked at it. But the fact is that we never felt, and I never felt, that we were really in danger. I mean, and partly this is a genetic flaw.
I mean, we got death threats that are unbelievable, really. But lots of people get them. That's the interesting thing. People who stand up, you know, in independent bookstores and have controversial speakers get them. So people get targeted like this. And I think once it happens to you, you decide, what can I do? I'm just going to pile these up in some outbox and not pay attention.
You know, I look at Glenn Greenwald as a model for right now of somebody. You could say, well, isn't he going to get taken down? Isn't he going to be arrested? Isn't he going to be? And I think that what he decided to do was to be noisier, not quieter, because being noisier, you find you have a lot of allies, actually. You have a lot of people who are willing to step up. But if you were hunkered down in your bunker, you wouldn't know that those allies were even there. So I'm kind of admiring the dance that Greenwald is involved
in. And Medea is another example.
Medea Benjamin's another one.
Or Angela Davis. I mean, people who go on and body forth all the time because they believe in what they're doing and their own integrity.
And there's another point, and I would say this is true for Medea, this is true for Bill Maher, this is true for Angela Davis. The attack on an Angela Davis or a Bill Maher or a Susan Sontag or an Edward Said, the victim of that attack isn't just Edward Said. The real target is the history teacher, the high school history teacher in Pennsylvania, or the English teacher in Stockton. These are the people who are being warned, if you step out of line, this could happen to you. So if they can go after a giant like Said or Sontag, what chance do I have? That's all the more reason, when you are targeted, to stand up. Your friend going to jail rather than taking down the names off of his website and so on. That's what we have to do, because that's what makes the emperor back up.
You published some of the choice items in the book. You two are dog shit. You are a filthy subhuman terrorist pig. And then he recanted that gentleman, Mike Adams, and said, well, that was a very mean and unchristian thing to say, even to a terrorist sociopath.
There's an apology for you.
For years, liberals have been denying that Ayers is a terrorist while falsely accusing NRA members of being terrorists. I don't know any who've done that. Now the bill's in the NRA. Leftists will have no choice but to admit the following. Bill Ayers is an unrepentant terrorist.
That's from a gentleman who signed me up for the NRA. I was suddenly getting the NRA journals, and I had a lot of that kind of craziness go on.
Now, some of it, for you as an English instructor, seemed to just amuse you. Bad grammar, metaphor abuse.
Well, you know, the most hateful, I mean, a lot of it was hateful, and a lot of it was racist, and yet I am a firm believer in talking even to your adversaries, even to your most noisy adversaries. Mm-hmm. So I have a little section in the book called Talking to the Tea Party, where I engage the people who come out to picket me. The most disgusting and disturbing part of those attacks were when they became viciously racist, and I think there was always a subtext of racism around, for example, the right-wing theory that I wrote Dreams from My Father. I mean, the assumption is Obama couldn't have written it, and that's obviously utter nonsense. But the other part that was disturbing was that when they went after Bernadine in these threats, it always had the most vicious kind of sexist and sexual innuendo and direct blatant stuff about, you know, sexual violence.
And tell our listeners about David Caton, one of your antagonists who you actually met in person.
That was a wonderful moment because I like to visualize these guys as kind of 45-year-old guys who sat in their mother's basements drinking scotch and smoking cigarettes with too much time on their hand and a couple of email addresses. But then I was signing books, I believe, in Denver, and a guy came up to me and introduced himself. And he had indeed been one of the people who was filled with hatred. And he was a normal-looking guy who, you know, was wearing, I think, khakis and a sports coat. And he was mild, you know, soft-spoken. And so I had to kind of challenge my own, stereotype of who he was. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I have found again and again that when I engage these guys, it's actually harder for them to go on spewing the stereotype than it was before I engaged them. So again and again, I've talked to people picketing me. I've found points of unity with, you know, not across the board, but certainly around questions like queer rights, questions like banning the Pentagon. I find a lot of libertarians, right libertarians, who agree with that part of my kind of left anarchist communist politics.
Well, and on pushing back against the surveillance state, we have some powerful allies who call themselves Republicans and Tea Party members. And I'll take it, because
absolutely,
we're not going to see Democrats. I mean, Rush Holt has done made some good moves. He's introduced a bill to repeal the Patriot Act and the FISA reforms, so-called reforms of 2008. But by and large, Democrats are afraid to challenge this president.
Aren't you just revolted by Dianne Feinstein?
Oh.
I mean, my God, she's your senator. She has been, I mean, the wonderful thing about the Greenwald-Snowden moment is that the stuff has been coming out and coming out and coming out slowly, drip by drip. And as soon as Alexander denies one thing, there's another thing. As soon as Dianne Feinstein says, ooh, that didn't happen, it did happen.
Or even if she's saying, well, we have the FISA court, and then one of the judges on the FISA court speaks up and says, we have no idea. We were given no instructions. We have no regulations. There's nothing we're following here.
And that's Reggie Walton.
That is Reggie Walton.
He's a made man.
You know that Reggie Walton is one of the fascinating things about him is that we criminal justice and juvenile justice advocates profiled him in 1999 because he was in trouble with the law as a young person. And we had a book that the Justice Department actually copied and published called about of 25 famous people in odd places who had been arrested for serious violent charges as a young person and was able to survive it really by luck or by somebody reaching in and holding on to them, because we were trying to fight back against the dreadful ways in which we incarcerate young people
and
of
Reggie
color
was
today.
One of those
and
people.
Reggie was one of them. He came to Chicago. Judge Walton came to Chicago. I'm not going to call him Reggie. Judge Walton at the time came to Chicago, and I took him to the juvenile detention center in Chicago, the Audi home, and he spoke to a very large group of people there about how no matter what kind of what happens to you as a young person, you can turn your life around. Hmm. He gave one of those kind of speeches. How ironic that he's on the FISA court and,
well, and
he
spoke up. He's there because he was the judge who gagged Sybil Edmonds. That's my inside theory.
Interesting.
She did some research on him. His judicial disclosure forms are sealed. We're not allowed to see him.
Wow. The secret government, the carceral state, the surveillance state.
I think judges are doing surprising things in Bill's story here about suing one of the students at the University of Wyoming, suing the federal government. Suing
the university
mm-hmm. in federal court. You go in front of a very conservative judge in Denver, and the head of the Wyoming University, the president of the University of Wyoming, goes mm-hmm. into court and says, of course free speech, but that's trumped by the need for safety and security. And this very conservative federal judge says, nope, read the First Amendment. I'm writing mm-hmm. an opinion, and I'm ordering you today to make provisions to have him speak. So it is a time, I think, also when empire is spinning down mm-hmm. at this moment. You have unusual allies in many of these cases.
Yeah, I would agree. Well, Bill Bernadine, thank you very much for trekking here to the secret studio, putting up with my barking dog.
Barking
She's
dog
adorable.
Was a pleasure.
And she likes my feet.
And you were a pleasure. And I have to say, finding the secret location was very, very difficult. I don't think anybody...
They won't be able to pry it out.
I don't think the NSA won't find it. And if Bernadine's called before a grand jury, I assure you she'll go to jail.
I will remain silent. Thank you, Peter. This was lovely.
The book is Public Enemy, Confessions of an American Dissident. My guests are Bill Ayers and Bernadine Dorn, and I truly recommend this book. It is a charming memoir of very troubling experiences that you endured, and the tone that you took the voice that you strike in the book, I think is remarkable.
Thank you so much.
And it just really engages the reader, and I enjoyed every page.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for your show and your work.
Well, I hope you enjoyed palling around with Bill Ayers and Bernadine Dorn as much as I did. They certainly have some powerful stories. Thanks for listening.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until